Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library, would like to thank our listeners, our guests, and our hosts for making us one of the top 35 library podcasts you must follow in 2020, as listed by Feedspot.com. We look forward to bringing you more quality entertainment within the new year, 2021, and for years to come. Thanks again, and Happy New Year.
Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Jessica with Turn the Page Podcast, Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Sharon Long, and I'm happy to be here.
And we are super excited to welcome back podcasting extraordinaire.
Hi, I'm Sarah Marshall, and I'm happy to be here also. I co-host You're Wrong About and another podcast called Why Are Dads? And they are about misremembered history and dad movies, respectively.
Which is an awesome way to go because actually only one of the movies we're going to be talking about today has a character with a dad in it, now that I'm thinking about it.
I guess that's the rule for animated children's media, primarily.
Right. Yeah. So this podcast grew out of the last time we were talking, which was we wanted to talk to you about You're Wrong About, where we just started talking about how after the interview, how we started talking about how terrifying children's movies were when we were kids.
Yeah.
So
I just decided to talk about that because there's so much material there, as pretty much everyone knows, I think.
Yeah, the 70s and 80s and early 90s, children's media was a little dark. And we're not even going to talk about our text today.
It's too much.
There could be, and I was saying to Sharon, there could be like a whole episode if you want to talk about like children's movies during that time, just called Christopher Lee, because that guy is really scary and they put him in a lot of children's media.
But yeah, curiously, John Huston.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know why they're just like you in children's media. We don't want
that. Really says it all, right? Because John Huston is the villain character in Chinatown, and meanwhile, the people who made animated films such as The Hobbit, which I grew up with, the animated Hobbit, which is certainly more terrifying and weirder, and yet definitely better than the very weird long trilogy we have now. And The Black Cauldron, both movies feature John Huston in a prominent role. And you're just like, well, I guess that's what they thought kids were into, John Huston.
So The Black Cauldron is a good segue into what we all decided we were going to talk about today, which is Don Bluth and his animation career. And this is actually a really good time to talk about him because I recently found out that they are working on a live action version of his animated video game Dragon's Lair.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So this is a good time to be talking about him. So where would we like to begin?
Oh, boy.
So Don Bluth was a huge animation fan. He was a big fan of Disney. He was a devout Mormon. He's actually a cousin of Mitt Romney.
Fun fact.
Yeah, I know, right?
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah, absolutely. I found out he took a hiatus from his animation career to go on mission, as one does. He went to Brigham Young University.
As one does.
I always assumed he was Jewish, because I just was like, obviously, it's a Jewish studio, and that's why they're bothering with the Jewish Mouse movie. It never occurred to me that he wasn't interested in that way. By which I mean attached to the concept. Yeah, I'm like, wow.
That really surprised me as well. And
So An American Tale came about because of Steven Spielberg, it seems.
Right.
He worked on a few Disney movies. A lot of them were animal based. There was, and he also worked a little bit on Pete's Dragon, which is also terrifying.
Yeah, very upsetting film.
Totally.
About child abuse and dragons.
Yeah, yeah, really. Like, I don't know how that's rated G on my kids' Disney Plus. And well, yet we have to jump to Moana, to my Disney Plus, to get to Moana. But
really?
Dragon, yeah.
But there's 80s ratings, and then there's current day ratings. So like a G in the 80s is like PG-13, let's be honest.
Mm. Yeah, it's true. Well, I mean, I don't know when PG was invented, because PG-13 was invented in 1984,
yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is why 16 Candles has boobs in it and is PG.
And why Goonies has cursing in it and is PG. Mm.
Right. You used to be able to say shit once in a PG movie in the early 80s, which is like a fascinating... Although I guess we've come back around on swearing. But yeah, there's this... Disney Plus is very weird because they're suddenly having to keep all their eras of media in the same place. And like a lot of it looks bad by
yeah,
today's
true.
Standards of like not being racist and stuff like that. So, you know,
yeah.
It's very strange. There's a lot of contextualizing that the platform isn't able to do.
Hmm.
Yeah. And Pete's Dragon is one of those movies that I can't remember when I originally saw it, but one of my sons picked it up and started watching it. And just that opening scene, I was like, oh my God, this is so scary. But you look at the dragon though, Elliot, and he's got like that square jaw. I think that if you look at Bluth's his game, knight has like that square jaw, and you can see it, and that's terrifying. So. So he works on a lot of like animal specific movies. And when he finally broke with Disney, he took a bunch of animators with him. And his first post Disney film, I believe, was The Secret of Nim.
That was 82. So that sounds.
Yes, 82.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah. I believe you are correct. The other ones came later.
Yeah.
And one of the ways I think you can tell, or one of the ways that I remember the date that The Secret of Nim came out is that the score, which is wonderful, is by Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. And either that same year or like maybe within a year of this movie being released, the third Omen movie came out, which also had a Jerry Goldsmith score, and they sound similar to each other. Like, ooh, you can kind of hear him overextending himself. Mm. And to me, it kind of, this was a movie that, you know, I have really loved since I was very young, and the music is a big part of that. And I feel like the fact that it has the same sort of like the same gravity as a movie that is basically about a battle between Jesus and the Antichrist, you know, is given to a kid's movie about rodents, because that's how seriously it's taking the story. And I really loved that and responded to it as a kid.
Secret of Nim is one of my favorite movies as a child, but it scared the, this not being specifically a PG-13 podcast, I will give you that one S-bomb, Sarah. it really, really scared me. And I was afraid of a lot of things, and I consumed children's media in the 70s, and well, not 70s, but because I was born in 79, a lot of it came after and I watched it, and then a lot of the 80s. And for some reason, I'd always go back to it. Like, no matter how much it scared me, I'd always go back to it. But I thought Secret of Nim was beautiful, and I did not realize it was based on a children's book, which was Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. They didn't use the name Frisbee. They called her Brisbee because of copyright infringement.
Yeah. Whammo, right?
I love.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really interesting just about that story in general is the Rats of Nim is, what is it, the National Institute for Mental Health, which should tell you all you need to know about what kind of book you're reading or what kind of movie you're going to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the book is wonderful too. And I remember, I think I first read it in fourth grade because the movie, you know, I often would read a book after becoming enchanted with the movie of it. And the book has, first of all, it was the reason that I had pet rats when I was growing up, because it really, you know, and one of the reasons I'm still a defender of rats as a species, because this is a book and movie less directly that are sort of very interested in random social stigma that appears for no reason. And there's a lot in the book is just, there's a lot of lovely sort of dry social commentary with the rats commenting on the fact that it's ridiculous that the humans have this thing they call the rat race, since rats would never do anything so silly.
And one of the really freaky things that we found out just about, like, you know, and also in the book, yeah, it was Universe 25.
Yeah, so Jessica had shared this fascinating article about the doomed mouse utopia that inspired Rats of NIMH. And it was fascinating. So this guy, right, and his name, Dr. John Bumpus Calhoun.
Which is a name.
Just, you know, seems perfect. Mm-hmm. He spent the 60s and 70s and just playing with thousands of rodents in these utopia setups that he, the largest of which, I think, was, like you said, Universe 25. Mm-hmm. And basically, they were given the run of the place. They had food and climate control and everything that rats needed for utopia. And yet it still failed horribly and became sort of a commentary on modern life. And it was just a fascinating article. And I, especially the fact that you know, the National Institute for Mental Health was actually, you know, that was part of what he was working for. So it was like literally the rats of
him. Oh, yeah. I feel like a lot of experiments in mid-century America were like, let's psychologically destroy some rats for science, you know? Because, like, they're, I mean, not this one so much, but there are experiments that are like, end in the result of, you know, if you deprive a rat of the ability to sleep endlessly, it's really bad for them. And it's like, yeah, like, what did you think exactly? Like, there's this sort of thing where we can, I don't know, it seems like humans are to some degree at this period abusing the right to, you know, test animals, like, not just at all, which I realize is a very contentious area in itself, but, like, if we are to accept that, there's, like, this immense casualness about scientific sociological experiments on animal subjects at the time, which it feels like, I don't know, I feel like there's this kind of wish fulfillment idea that I love, especially in a book directed at children, and the idea that some of these subjects are going to become more intelligent than their experimenters and just respond not by seeking revenge or doing anything petty, but just by going off and creating their own society.
Yeah, so Bluth made this movie, and this movie was like the anti-Disney movie.
Says it all.
And there is a scene that explicitly shows humans experimenting on rats. Rats are getting injections. It's absolutely terrifying. The main character, Mrs. Brisby in the movie, she wants to save her son who's dying and he's sick and her cinder block house is sinking. And she gets this amulet that has magical powers that I wanted so badly.
It's like the heart of the ocean, but red, basically.
Yeah. But it is gory. I mean, it is absolutely gory. There's blood. The characters have, like, saliva that's like...
This is another one of those animated movies, which I think this is also something you see in this era, the sort of the 70s and 80s, which are like this kind of lost age almost of hand-drawn animation, I feel like, because mid-century Disney really created the aesthetic that Disney is still running on. And they've come back, you know, in the 90s and created something that has galloped toward computers and become very smooth and perfect. And there's just a lot of strange artistry happening in the 70s and 80s, I think, that really is just feels unique now. And there's Yeah, this is just a gooey time. Like, this movie has a lot of mud in it. And also, like one of my strongest memories of the Rankin Bass Hobbit is just like goo and goblin spit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and he's definitely got that in The Secret of Nim. I mean, yeah. And the thing that
these movies are gross.
Oh, so much, Sharon, about that scene with the owl.
First of all, the owl with the eyes, and that gets reflected again with the other character.
Nicodemus?
Yes, Nicodemus. Yeah. They both have those glowing eyes, which are terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then the owl, as Mrs. Brisby approaches, there's like a giant spider that comes mm-hmm. around, and the owl squashes it, and it's just goo and green guts, and it's disgusting. But yeah, that scene just like stuck with me, you know, as far as the gross out factor.
Yeah, and also really menacing sets. And this is something that it feels like Disney was doing too. Like, they were at least, I think, in The Black Cauldron, you can see them trying this out. Just characters moving through spaces that just look so menacing, like dark and thorny and you know, just even just something as benign as Mrs. Brisby, I think going to see anybody really, like she has to move through some kind of terrifying landscape that would be absolutely nightmarish for a child to contemplate. And I also think something that's going on here that I know I responded to as a kid is that like, this movie is very scary, but the protagonist is an adult woman mouse. She's a mom. And you just, as a kid, I was like, well, this is really freaky, but like she can handle it.
So yeah, I love that it was a mom.
Mm-hmm. And moms can do anything and they'll take care of everything. So
certainly as a kid, I was very able to believe that. And there's something about Disney, like my vendetta against Disney personally comes from the fact that they really love to just stack the odds against you being able to not just be in your feelings basically as a result of what they're doing. So it's like Baby Deer loses his mom. It's like, that's just a movie twisting your arm behind your back and demanding that you have feelings. And like, I don't know why Don Bluth movies don't feel like that to me, because they are very intense. Like, they have these very emotional scores. They are about lost children and children losing their parents, you know, as much as Disney ever was. But there's just something about the way they're made that like is both scarier and yet less upsetting, like less scarier and less sad or something than mm-hmm. Disney was, in a way that I remember feeling weirdly safer to me when I was a kid, because I felt less sort of hammered by the experience than if I watched something like Dumbo, which is just like, I won't even watch Dumbo now. I mean, forget about it.
Dumbo. And I think it's, you know, you also have it's because it's based on the book. You know, you do have a very different kind of protagonist in Secret of Nim. And there is a separation, but this time, instead of the child being separated from the parent, it's the parent being separated from the child. And a good mom will do anything to take care of their child, even deal with really scary looking saliva spitting rats and
even the spitty cats.
Yeah, but even the ones that were scary, they weren't always bad guys. And that was one thing that I really liked about it. Like, you would think that, you know, like that Nicodemus was just awful, but I don't think that he was like the major antagonist. But
no, he's a good guy.
He was a good guy. Nice. Yeah. And he was scared, but he was scary looking, but you had affection for him. And then you had like, was it the crow who did that whole
Jeremy.
I love kids and kids love me.
This is also, you know, important in establishing Dom DeLuise as a presence in childhood, because he's going to return in the American Tale movies, and he's like, I don't know. I love the like Dom DeLuise type adult in these stories, because it's like, it's not someone who's super helpful, but they come through in just the right moment though, you know, like that's a really, I don't know. I love just it when Dom DeLuise shows up.
Attention breaker, just sort of like intermission.
And just like, of all the kind of relief you can choose. But that there are characters that are just perhaps initially scary looking in the context of what we expect from animation, but are just perfectly lovely. And it's like, yeah, sometimes rats get really, really old, and they just look old. They're old rats. It's just what happens. They're very nice.
There's the whole aspect of, Jonathan Frisbee, right? Mm. The husband that was like, he was in cahoots with them. And, you know, there was that whole side of things where they actually were excited to help out once they found out that this was the white Jonathan. So I like that part of it.
So moving on to An American Tale, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting movie because it was there's a lot of Steven Spielberg in it. Was it Roger Ebert who called it the most depressing children's movie of all time?
That sounds like something Roger Ebert would say. It was weird though, because like I can easily think of five children's movies off the top of my head that are more depressing, and I've already mentioned two of them.
He name dropped Return to Oz in that review, which
that one's just weird.
It's oh my weird. God, the Wheelies, so weird.
I mean, I think that was actually in the Oz books, which are weird and have their own issues to begin with. But yeah, it was weird, and just Firouza Balk is somebody else. Even as a child, she probably shouldn't have been in children's movies. No offense, Firouza, but that movie began with Dorothy having electroshock therapy.
Wow.
But Roger Ebert called An American Tale the most depressing movie, children's movie of all time. And I remember very distinctly not just seeing it, but getting a book that preceded it. And growing up, you know, I grew up in a Jewish family partially from Russia. And we celebrated Hanukkah, and that was not something you saw in children's movies or movies in general. And that was very interesting to me to have both, you know, like a family from where my family came from and a family that celebrated Hanukkah in the 80s. And it's still not something you see all that much now. Most holiday movies are Christmas movies. Still. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we went to see that, and I know I remember liking it, even though I was scared of it. I think my parents and the parents of the friends I went with maybe were a little baffled by how dark it was. But yeah, so that movie came about because Steven Spielberg really wanted a movie that showed the immigrant experience for children. And Feivel is the Yiddish name for Steven Spielberg's grandfather, whose name was Philip. And he really wanted the main character to be named Feivel. So he went to Bluth for this. And Bluth, from what I understand, was kind of iffy about the name, but Spielberg was like, nope, it must be this. So kind of going back to the whole thing that, you know, Bluth was this devout, or still, I don't want to say was, because he's still active, and he might be listening to this, and
he's
I apologize.
He's just not still actively a force in our emotional lives like he was at one time.
So, you know, there was this movie about the immigrant experience in the late 1800s, early 1900s for children with mice, and the mice were all from oppressed areas, and the cats played their oppressors. So this kind of coincided with the book release of Mouse by Art Spiegelman.
I didn't realize that. Wow.
There was a possible lawsuit because
Well, Art Spiegelman accused Spielberg of plagiarism, right?
I don't know. I do know those are like two of my favorite pieces of media that exist. So I mean, I was just so busy wondering about the great mouse detective and who between Disney and Bluth was plagiarizing each other if they were.
So now the way it worked itself out, instead of actually pursuing the litigation, it had something to do with the release date I guess Spiegelman convinced the publishers to split it into two volumes.
Right. Which is why there's Mouse Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Oh, wow.
So that he could get it out faster.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I would never have guessed that book came out in two parts, not as an intentional artistic choice.
It just works that way. Yeah.
An American tale.
First of all, it's hard to say whether or not there really was plagiarism there because, I mean, first of all, Bluth himself worked on a bunch of mouse-centric Disney movies before, like The Rescuers.
Right. Yeah, and mice have been on the scene for a while.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, you mentioned The Great Mouse Detective, which I believe came out around...
I think that was 86 also.
Yeah, so An American Tale, one of the other criticisms that I believe Siskel and Ebert had about it, and this wasn't something I realized until I was rereading about it, was that even though the Mouskowitz family, because mouse puns... and names were pretty big. That was Feivel's family, Feivel Mouskowitz, were coded as Jewish. Both stereotypically and in practice, the father is pretty much like Fiddler on the Roof father. Doesn't he play a fiddle?
Yes. Wow. Yeah, and he has the same shirt.
And the same build as.
And they're in a little town. As Zira Mostel or yes. Topple or whoever.
But they felt that in the fact that they didn't specifically say that these mice were Jewish or that they're specifically celebrating Hanukkah, although I remembered it as they did, but apparently not. They said that, you know, they played it too safe with that they didn't call out like these are Jewish mice.
Yeah. Huh. They said he chickened out on its ethnic heritage, which I thought was an interesting criticism.
I would ask Roger Ebert himself to go, you know, make a Jewish mouse movie where at some point someone says we are Jewish, because that I just like I something I think of often is a New Yorker piece about the making of Sister Act, written by the original screenwriter who later had his name taken off of it, and how they were like, We should have a love interest for Whoopi Goldberg, but like we're in a bind here because if her love interest is black, then we're going to alienate the racist audience who doesn't want to see too many black people. And if her love interest is white, we're also going to alienate the racist audience. So how do we least alienate the racist audience? And they're just having these mathematical conversations apparently about just, you know, this degree of risk. It's like just write a screenplay and then cast people in it. Like, it's just, you have a lot of money. Like, it's okay if you alienate the racist audience or the anti-Semitic audience at times. But I do feel like, it, you know, yeah, that's exactly the kind of conservativism that I actually didn't notice this movie practicing. Like, I would have sworn that they specifically said they were celebrating Hanukkah. I'm surprised that my brain filled that in for me, but it makes sense.
And I'm wondering if it was in the book version that I had as a child, which is buried someplace in my parents' house with my Feivel Mouskowitz doll with his giant heavy hat, which, so one of the things that I, you know, about just in general about Bluth's style is everything is very heavy. He seems to have like a very heavy hand, and that's not a criticism, but you know, everything has weight. So the Mouskowitz family, they're fleeing the cat sacks, which are supposed to be the Cossacks, in this horrifying scene where their village gets burned down. They board this ship and they meet all of these other stereotypical immigrant mice who have their own stories as to how they came to be immigrants to America, and they have that song "There Are No Cats in America," which would make the internet very sad if that were true. it's a very weird song, and I watched it several times while preparing for this, because again, you have like this one cat in Italy and they talk about Sicily, and there's the very clearly coded mafiosa cat who kills the mother and throws her rosary out. And he's so sad about it. But then he gets up and he starts dancing. But there are no cats in America. Because, you know,
Yeah, this is the part of the movie that is the Godfather 2 for children. And I really, I'm enamored of how detailed this allegorical world gets, because it's essentially mice just acting out what the humans are doing in their own little parallel reality, and they have the same problems and the same figures. And we get as far as having a mouse boss Tweed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I'm talking about that.
And
the
then
alcoholic politician. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah.
Honest well, John.
Honest John. Yeah. So yeah, I was going to talk about how annoyed I was that the Irish cat describes the male cat that killed his sweetheart as a calico. And then I'm like, that is so rare genetically for a male cat to be a calico. Fievel gets separated from his parents in this crazy storm.
Scary, scary storm.
The rain just picks the ship specifically to rain on, and there's a wave that looks like the devil. Again, like you can feel the weight of the water. And he gets to America the same time as his parents, but he's there in a bottle because he fell off the ship, and his parents go to Mouse Ellis Island, and he gets sold to a sweatshop.
Mm-hmm. He sure does.
Yeah. Which, again, is like, in a kid's movie, I feel like, I don't know if that would happen today in a kid's movie.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think this movie is attempting to express the reality of the experience of immigration in some way that is
amazing.
Yeah. And you can't do it without it being terrifying. So,
they
achieved that.
It did, because that's very much what would have happened to a child. I mean, even a child who came with his family might have ended up in a sweatshop because you need money. The streets aren't really paved with cheese.
I think the closest Disney came to this actually was Newsies.
Oh,
because
yes.
That is an attempt to depict, you know, with some realism and really a surprising adherence to history, like the experience of being a street kid in New York, trying to avoid getting picked up and taken to the house of refuge where you're going to be incarcerated and subject to months of hard labor. But they didn't get behind that movie, and nobody saw it when it came out. So it's nowhere on the scale of this.
No, not at all. And it had a drunk politician in it, a drunk mouse politician, who I believe might have been Irish.
Honest John.
Because less with the stereotypes.
Yeah, that was like a Tammany Hall type of a.
And then there were the cats, and the cats were terrorizing the mice. But there was Dom DeLuise, who was the cat with the heart of gold, who was a vegetarian.
Yeah, he likes to play a friend to mice. I guess that's a nice role.
And it worked for him, and it worked. He was just this big, like, chubby, jolly cat, very fluffy. I guess they didn't want to completely alienate the cat lovers.
there you go. They couldn't take a stand on that or whether or not they were Jewish.
Not all cats. Not all cats.
Yeah, well, especially after The Secret of Nim, like, the cats... Yeah, cats don't come off well at all in that movie, so they might have felt the need to address a backlash.
Was this the movie where Dom DeLuise was just ad-libbing and they extended his role in the movie, or is that a different movie? I'm just trying to remember, because I read that.
Wow, I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah.
I feel like that could be the story with the sequel also, because definitely a lot of Dom DeLuise in the sequel.
He was, I guess, what one would call the breakout character.
He's the Olaf, yeah.
He is, yeah. You know, because that whole he has that song and with Fievel, which I forgot existed. Just like Never Say Never, I completely forgot that.
Me
song
too.
Existed,
yeah.
Called a duo, and it sounds like he's ad-libbing in that song. You know, big fluffy butterflies with. So that would make sense. I thought that movie really worked. It was really scary. And it has its stuff. But as a child, there were a lot of things I loved about it, even though I had nightmares about that storm and a bunch of other things that happened in that movie for probably months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And yeah. I think I don't remember having bad dreams about any of these movies that were intense for me as a kid, but just, I mean, to me, it's like all about just this immediate emotional response to them now. Like if I hear, you know, any of the opening music from the if I hear any of the music from the opening credits of any of these movies, like I just, you know, just am completely transported basically to childhood. I think that's maybe one of the ways that animation, if it's done well, can make it us so vulnerable. And I don't know why it's able to do that, but it definitely happens to me and it seems to happen to other people.
Moving on from that, because All Dogs Go to Heaven is a whole other ball game. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of in the decline of Bluth's big boom. There is The Land Before Time, which spawned yes. like almost like 13 sequels or something. And that movie,
I think actually yeah. 13. Yeah.
Lucky 13.
And a show.
and a TV show, yes. But that movie, so that's another movie that has a very dramatic rain scene, but that's about dinosaurs. It was originally supposed to have no dialogue at all, from what I've been reading. Hmm. Huh. But yeah, and I don't think it had a song like Somewhere Out There, which was.
It has a Diana Ross song in it.
Oh, it does. Yes, yeah. It does. I forgot about that.
It's great. I love that. I love imagining them having to approach Diana Ross and being like, so we have this movie that we're doing. We would love for you to contribute. It's about grieving the death of your dinosaur mom. And we just think you'd be a fit.
And she was like, sure, let's do this.
She was like, I think I am a fit. And she was. Yeah.
Because Somewhere Out There, I think, was like an Oscar nominated song. With the success of that, you know, I think Steven Spielberg co-signed on Land Before Time as well, which is funny because then he went on to do Jurassic Park. There's this movie about dinosaurs and it has a parental death scene that happens on screen before Simba loses his dad on screen, although they're very similar scenes where our protagonist, our long neck, which is a brontosaurus, I guess now we're told that brontosauruses aren't what we thought they were, but anyway.
Yeah, however, when Littlefoot's dad finally shows up, and I believe the 10th Land Before a Time sequel, we do learn that his name is Braun or Bront. I forget. So they're going with the Brontosaurus thing. It just sounds better than Apatosaurus.
Of course. or long neck, but you know.
Well, long neck is the best. It's, you know, because then he can't be wrong, you know. Just long necks, flyers, swimmers.
She has this terrifying fight with a sharp tooth, a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And she dies, and they're looking for this great valley where things are going to be good, but she dies in front of Littlefoot, and in the rain, he's like, Mom, get up, why aren't you getting up? And it's so upsetting, it's so upsetting, but I read a quote where Bluth really wanted a scene like that, because there are children who really have lost their parents, and, you know, felt like it would be therapeutic for that, to see that on screen.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me to think about the fact that this was a new thing to bring into the world, because Bambi is like, everything happens, you don't see anything. And it feels very of its time, because like Bambi's dad steps in and he's this like very scary adult masculine deer who's like, your mother can't be with you. And it's like, oh, that's comforting. He's like, and they're like, you gotta be prince of the forest now. And it's like, great, that's very helpful with me and my bereavement. And like, we're really talking about how to get through this emotionally. You just flash forward to being an adult.
it is like very much about the grieving process, because Littlefoot, you know, finds a family of his own, and spoiler alert, eventually finds his grandparents in the Great Valley, you know, with other orphaned dinosaurs or dinosaurs that have lost their families, including Sarah, who's a Triceratops, who's kind of a bit of a brat. Littlefoot and Fievel, they both spend a lot of the movie grieving and trying to get through. And same thing with Mrs. Brisby. I mean, she's
she's basically trying to stop the imminent death of her child, and that's her motivation. And the whole thing is like, we have to move the cinder block so that he doesn't have to be exposed to the cold weather, which means he will surely die. So it's like the stakes are always like, I have lost the most important person in the world to me, or I am about to, or I think I have.
This is like a really good, I think a really just a good topic for the pandemic, because we're all struggling. A lot of us, all three of us, people who grew up with these movies that, I mean, they were very beloved, but again, like looking back on them, they were scary. At least for me, I was really afraid of like everything. So I have to preface that. Like there were very few things that didn't scare me when I was a kid. You know, like now I know, like with me, I have children and I'm working full time and, you know, I'm taking care of them and trying to keep them healthy and have opted to do like a remote school. And my parents, who are older in their 70s, are helping. And it's just like, I feel the weight of the cinder block.
Yeah.
Like, and that Bluth drawn cinder block, not a nice light Disney cinder block.
No, that's true. One. A Disney cinder block would be very fluffy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I feel like I actually have strong feelings about the Land Before Time sequels because I've spent time with friends who had at the time a toddler who loved all of them pretty much equally. And so we just had them all on constantly when I was around and also when I was not around, which is why his parents knew them by heart. And one of the things that I find so odd about the way the story changed in sequel form and how we now remember it is that it just becomes this series of episodic adventures, most of which don't have very high stakes at all. Where like they're in the Great Valley, which is this very prosperous, nice place. And the plots are basically, they leave the Great Valley to have an adventure or a threat comes to the Great Valley, but it endures basically. And they don't grow up and they just have, you know, little baby dinosaur adventures. And it's, you know, it becomes a very safe space, to imagine being a child. And I feel like in the original movie, the Great Valley is important because the dinosaurs seem to be on their way to be going extinct. And I feel as if this movie is really, it feels to me like an expansion of the dinosaur sequence in Fantasia, which is like one of the most upsetting things I've ever seen.
Yeah,
because
that's
the
true.
Way they introduce the dinosaurs in Fantasia is like dinosaurs used to exist. And then they died horribly. And we're going to show you a little bit of the first thing and a lot of the second thing. So, yeah, and this is Stravinsky. And then that's how you get exposed to Stravinsky as a child, basically.
That's true, though. Fantasia existed, and it was scary, and it was Disney. But, like, was it really a children's movie in the way that, you know?
Like, I don't think anyone knew what Fantasia was, which I think is why it tanked when it first came out. But but I feel, but yeah, like this definitely is better than Fantasia because there's a story and you're not just watching random dinosaurs with no names die. But, you know, the Great Valley is a place they're trying to get to in this movie because it is like one of the last places that any of the dinosaurs can find where they can presumably for like a little while, like maybe a generation or a few generations. I think in the end we're told that like some generations of dinosaurs lived well in the Great Valley. And you're like, that's nice. But like, I guess all the dinosaurs are going to be dead in like 200 years or something anyway. Like, yeah, like it's a movie that's sort of giving you a soft intro to the idea of extinction, which has honestly been the big theme of, you know, Gen Xers and millennials growing up. And I don't think that was totally by accident.
We are very much shaped by that, which is, you know, why, like, at the time I spent as a children's librarian, You know, like I'd get some parents who would talk about like, oh, well, like I thought that this movie was really scary. And I was like, have you seen The Secret of NIMH? Because I grew up with that. And this movie is not scary compared to that. Mm. But I'm not saying anything bad about it because, you know, you do have like movies like now you have Lion King. And there was that Pixar movie, The Good Dinosaur, which had a parental death scene on camera, which was really scary. So I guess like my point isn't like, oh, these kids today are a bunch of softies because they didn't grow up with Don Bluth. I think because people who are making media now did grow up with Don Bluth and their kids, that kids are probably more resilient than you think. And I'm not saying like go out and show your kids a bunch of movies with like Christopher Lee in it, or, you know, like you don't have to show them the Swamp of Sadness scene from The Neverending Story. I think they're able to get it a little bit more than people realize.
I feel as if when I was a kid, like, to me, the deciding thing was and has always been, like, does this character have agency? And if they have agency and if they're resourceful and can respond to a situation and kind of figure some stuff out, then it feels much easier for me to see them facing a lot of peril than if they just have really no ability to protect themselves and are in like a lower stakes situation, technically. Like, once again, Dumbo, no thank you, none for me. You know, and just so these, and I think that as a kid too, like, I know that I certainly felt a connection to stories that confirmed my sense that the world was a pretty scary place and that it was easier to accept that it was scary and then think about how to deal with that than to just pretend that it was not scary.
I think that that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. You got to give kids credit for, you know, being the sort of have those feelings and emotions too, you know, like they're definitely little sponges that pick up on stuff. So
in these fantastical situations with anthropomorphized animals, you can see where it comes from. You learn like, okay, so Fievel had his issues, but like he had street smart friends who were able to sort of help him because he was a little hapless.
I think this is another nice thing about these movies, actually, that's like so obvious that I've been overlooking it, I guess, is that these also, all three of the movies we're talking about are about teamwork. And like Littlefoot isn't a particularly interesting protagonist, which is like becomes more obvious over the 800 movies he has to be the main character of, but like it isn't really about him. It starts out about him, but it's really about this group of friends coming together and, you know, ignoring the adult dinosaur ideas that different types of dinosaurs can't be friends with each other. And, you know,
yes, absolutely.
Also, isn't that also the plot of New Girl?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's about a bereaved little dinosaur who finds other little lovable little dinosaurs to live with in an apartment.
A bunch of oddballs, and it's not about the new girl. It's about the friends. Sorry, I haven't a real special place in my heart for New Girl.
No, that's a frequent premise that I really like. And I was just watching the pilot of Cheers and I was like, this has the same pilot as Friends, which is that someone is attempting to get married and then they're, you know, either they run out on their fiance or vice versa. And then they end up as, you know, a server and they meet a new misfit group of friends, you know, and then that becomes their life. And it's much better than getting married because sometimes you want to get married and sometimes you want to have friends. So, Don Bluth.
Don Bluth, everybody. I want to thank Sarah so much for coming on and chatting with us about this. Again, like you're totally welcome to come on and talk about your book when it comes out.
Oh, thank
you. Anything at all.
Anything at all. If you want to come back and talk about the Swamp of Sadness, you are welcome.
I would like love to come back for whatever like random pop culture related idea occurs to you all, because like this was really made me very happy to do, and it's just really, it's very nice to get to visit with you guys.
Thank you so much. So once again, this was Jessica
and this is Sharon,
and our guest
Sarah Marshall.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.